Ladies and gentlemen, joining us at the commissioner's table is Congressman Jim McDermott of the 7th District. We will now continue with the program. As you know, we're trying to move ahead to catch up with the 37 minutes we lost this morning. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Lina Khalaftufaha, and I work with the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. While many public officials are quick to condemn hate crimes and discrimination, we call to your attention today the fact that the actions of the government have created a general climate where racial profiling and discrimination are tolerated and perpetuated in airports, on the streets, in the workplace, and in our own neighborhoods. According to the Labor and Immigration Organizing Network, discrimination in the workplace increased dramatically after September 11th. Employers have been quick to call in the FBI or the INS or to fire workers for minor incidents. Government actions have directly contributed to this. For example, the Social Security Administration, SSA, has stepped up its No Match program, which informs employers of Social Security numbers that don't match its database. In the recent past, the SSA has sent out about 40,000 No Match letters. This year, it is sending approximately 750,000. The result has been a surge in the number of workers being fired because they are suspected of not having proper documentation, even though the letter itself notes that a mismatch is not sufficient cause for firing a worker. In the wake of September 11th, many states are considering measures that would deny immigrants access to driver's licenses. During the most recent state legislative sessions, including here in Washington State, approximately 46 bills were introduced that sought to restrict immigrants' ability to get driver's licenses. Most of these bills were put forth in the name of anti-terrorism measures. These measures change the fundamental purpose of a driver's license from a document that shows that a driver knows the rules of the road to a national identification card. They will force immigrants who must use a card to do so without testing, licensure, and without insurance. The criminal justice system, which was already focused disproportionately on communities of color, began to show renewed signs of racial profiling and disproportionate treatment, particularly to Arab, Muslim, and Southeast Asian men. Immigrant communities of color became the target of increased suspicion and harsher treatment by police officers, the courts, and related government agencies, such as the Child Protective Services. All of these actions attest to a climate of increased discrimination and fear facing immigrant communities of color. When our federal and state governments engage in such actions as racial profiling, indiscriminate arrests, and secret detentions, it creates the space and sets the tone for businesses and employers and indeed communities and neighborhoods to engage in racist, discriminatory, and dangerous behavior. The next testimonies will highlight these practices and their impacts on our communities.
Good afternoon. My name is Noor and I'm from Afghanistan. I came here 2 years ago as a political asylum. And it was on July 13, me and my girlfriend, who's an American citizen, we went for a weekend getaway to Lake Moses.
A little closer to the mic.
Oh, I'm sorry. Which is located in eastern Washington. And we went there camping. As soon as we tried to put up the tent, there was like 40 people. They said it's okay to camp here. It was all white people. And as soon as I tried to put up the tent, the sheriff pulled over. And because we look foreigners, he asked us to leave. So when I asked him why, he said it's a private land and we can camp there. Then he assumed we were drinking and he was going to give my girlfriend a ticket. So I said, okay, we haven't been drinking and we're going to leave if it's private land. So then he says, oh, can I see your ID, sir? So I show them my ID. My name is in Middle Eastern and my license. So as soon as I gave him my ID, he looked at my ID and he says, oh, you're under arrest, sir. I was like, for what? What'd I do? Obstructing a police officer, which we didn't even do anything. So he arrested me. He didn't even let me put on some clothes. He arrested me actually with my swimming suit, which was just underwear. So he took me to jail. Then he took my license. He never gave my license back to me. Then I was in jail for 2 days. They thought I was some sort of illegal alien until they called immigration and they came and I was bonded out. The police never gave my license back, and also yet a way to get inside my political asylum case. I don't know how. He found out everything, how I came to the United States, what was my case all about. A sharif. He had gone into my case, and also while he had all the information, he called the jail and he said, oh, this guy is illegal. So I stayed 2 days in jail. I bonded for $500. Then I went to court to fight my case. My lawyer advised me that if I fight my case, take it to trial, and I lose it, then I'm going to face immigration consequences. Then I will be deported back to Afghanistan. So I took the lesser charges. I plea bargained for lesser charges. I was fined $500, paid $500 to the lawyer. But it's not the money that I paid at. Now, I'm going to go for my entry for green card in about a few months. And this is in my record. And the immigration, as soon as they look at this, they're going to put me back in jail, that little stinky jail that they have in downtown. I don't know if you guys have seen it. They have this really nasty, dirty jail in downtown airport way. So I'm going to go there, and they can't deport me back to Afghanistan because Afghanistan doesn't have a legitimate government. So I'm going to be staying there for at least 2-3 years until Afghanistan have a legitimate government. Then they can deport me back for something we didn't even do. And I feel this was a clear attack by police over my religion, nationality, and even though a crime was committed against me, I had to plead guilty to crime that I did not commit. I did this because I was afraid of the immigration consequences, that I would be deported because of these charges. I feel this is really unfair. I should be able to go to trial and fight my case without the fear that I would lose my life and air in the United States. The only reason I came to America is to have freedom, civil rights, human rights, which we didn't have in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, our rights were, people were abused by Talibans. I mean, I've lost family members, I've lost my father, I've lost 3 uncles, I've lost 3 cousins, I've lost my niece by Taliban regimes, and they were killed right in front of my eyes. I've been myself tortured, beaten by Talibans in my head with AK-74. And that's why I came to America, to at least have. I did not come to America for a good life. I came here to live as a human because we did not have the right in Afghanistan. But now I'm facing all these charges and all my future has been destroyed now because of just this little thing, and we didn't even do it. So I think I'm asking the legislators, the lawmakers, to give the immigrants a little right to at least fight their case, to take it to trial without the fear of the immigration laws and regulations. This way we lose and we're going
to... Oh,
I'm sorry. I should have put that little thing right there. So this way we can have some rights to fight our cases and stand up for our rights, because this is the only reason we came to America. And that's all I'm asking you guys. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name's Susan Foster, and I'm a partner with the law firm of Perkins Coie. In April of this year, I had the opportunity to represent 3 local Somali halal grocers who had been charged with food stamp trafficking and disqualified from the USDA food stamp program. Local Somalis had been the subject of governmental action previously, and community members expressed concern that the community was being targeted based upon their religion and ethnicity. Based upon my experience as counsel in the subsequent USDA appeal, I have to concur. There is, in fact, a different set of rules being applied to those who are suspect simply because of their race, religion, or ethnicity. I would like to play for you now an excerpt from a USDA interview of Mr. Nur prior to his disqualification. Please remember that there has never been any allegation that he is a terrorist or has any terrorist affiliation. In this excerpt that we're going to play, Mr. Nur has stepped out of the room, leaving the USDA officials to confer amongst themselves.
Before we go any further, I just wanted to...
He stepped out for just a moment, Fred.
Oh, he did?
And he went to get a letter.
Oh.
He's getting his phone down. I'm going to go in and we'll
Did you take down the hallway?
Maybe
a bomb or something in it.
Maybe he has a bomb in it or something. These officials were there to hear his explanations and assess his guilt or innocence. But in their mind, he wasn't simply a small business owner. He was a Somali Muslim, and thus suspect of being a bomb-carrying terrorist. Mr. Nur's explanations regarding Somali culture and purchasing habits were going to fall on deaf ears. And indeed, as this next excerpt shows, the fundamental due process right that we all have to be presumed innocent until proven guilty simply was not applied in this case.
Yeah, okay, I understand. It is not illegal for us, he said, to check by telephone for the person if they had.
No, the trafficking in food stamps is illegal. And you have not proven yet that you haven't been doing that.
So you say that again, sir?
I said, no, you're right. What you just said is not illegal. However, trafficking in food stamps is illegal, and you have not yet proven that you have not been trafficking.
He had to prove that he was not.
Well, in this biased environment, he was unable to prove his guilt.
Before we go any further, I just wanted to...
Cut the tape, please. In this biased environment, he was unable to prove his innocence, and he was, in fact, disqualified. Even on appeal, these grocers were dealt with disparate treatment. They were denied fundamental due process rights, such as the very right to review the evidence presented against you. In this case, unlike most cases, we were denied the full report that was sent to the administrative review officers. USDA officials expressed some surprise at this. However, the official USD report was to deny that information to us. Our FOIA request, seeking information for which we could defend our client and also to determine the basis for this governmental action, were also not dealt with the same as they would be in other cases. Our requests were had documents withheld, and even the very tape that you heard was not initially provided to us. Only because we saw a reference to it in another document and we asked about it were we provided a tape. That tape was of such poor quality that we had to use internal and external resources to enhance that tape, only to find out it was the wrong tape. Then we got this one. We've had targeted governmental action, biased enforcement, a lack of due process, and a lack of fundamental fairness and due process, all conducted behind a veil of secrecy. The question that must be answered in this and other cases: what is the specific governmental directive that has authorized, condoned, and allowed this type of treatment? What is the government going to do to ensure that our community does not continue to live in fear? An open government allows these questions to be asked. An open government gives you the documents that you can debate these questions and answer these questions. To paraphrase a recent judicial decision, difficult times such as these have always tested our fidelity to the core democratic values of openness, government accountability, and the rule of law. But it's perhaps even more important at such times to allow our system of justice to work so as to ensure that our government always operates within the statutory and constitutional constraints which distinguish a democracy from a dictatorship. With the assistance of the community, political leaders, local relief organizations, a large law firm, and even PricewaterhouseCoopers got involved here, we were able to reverse the disqualification decisions. But those types of resources are not going to be available to every individual who's the subject of governmental persecution. September 11th left us all feeling a deep and abiding sense of fear. I don't know if you remember last Sunday, but the Prowlers went by the stadium. I was in my office building on the 43rd floor. I can tell you, as those engines came through, I and others in the building were shaking with fear. But I am shaking even more with a sense of fear that those fundamental core democratic values that I learned as a teenager and which led me to a choice of law are being trampled. That all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that no person shall be denied life, liberty, property, without due process of law, that justice is for all. I ask now that as we pursue security, that we also recognize that we need to renew our commitment to these principles so as to ensure that justice is, in fact, provided to all. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Hardeep Reki. I'm 24 years old. I was born and raised in Seattle. I'm a third-year law student at Tulane University. I received my undergraduate degree from Whitman College and went to high school here in Seattle at Bush School. I am a sick American, as are 99% of all Americans that wear turbans. Like all Americans, sick Americans have contributed richly to the workplace and the American in general. The first Asian American to become a congressman was a sick. The inventor of fiber optics that forms the heart of all telecommunications around the world is a sick American. The chief marketing officer for Palm Incorporated is a sick American. America's largest peach grower is a sick American. And last but not least, one of the first doctors to arrive on the scene and to treat victims of Ground Zero, and indeed a true hero of 9/11, is a sick American. Some fellow Americans, however, when they look at me or other sicks, don't always see a fellow American. Generally, I've always been treated differently. I've been pointed out and set apart in public places by both the general public and people with governmental authority. This is especially true at airports, where although they claim that all searches are random, I've been searched about 80% of the time that I've flown. I specifically remember sitting next to a lady, and she was saying she didn't quite understand why everybody was so upset about these searches, that it doesn't happen that frequently. I interrupted her and I asked her, how many times have you been searched? And she said once in the 3 or 4 round trips that she had taken. I told her I've been searched approximately 8 times in the 4 or 5 times that I've flown. Somehow it seems that the random number generator seems to pick 6 more frequently than any other community. But it's not even the searches that bother me. What bothers me is the way that these searches are perceived by the public. What bothers me the most is that when the public constantly sees a certain group of people being picked out of the crowd on a consistent basis, that they also become suspicious of that group. What I mean to say is that when you go to the airport and you see every time you go there you're confronted with a turban man being searched, it starts to perpetuate the stereotypes that exist. Perpetuates the stereotypes that turban people are bad, that turban people are terrorists, that turban people, for some reason, are deserving of higher scrutiny than other citizens. Ultimately, in the light of all the events that have occurred, in the face of all the harassment that I have personally faced, and that many that look similar to me have faced, I've had to change my view on what I once thought this country was all about. I had to change my thoughts about what I was born and raised believing American ideals were. At some point, and perhaps it was a bit naive, I believe there is no such thing as a second-class citizen. I'm living proof that there is such a class. Both the state and federal government, both the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch, are willing to give a false sense of security to the first-class citizens at the expense of a second-class citizen. Thank you.
My name is Asha Mohammed, and I'm here today on behalf of the Somali community. After September 11, the Somali were targeted. A few days after the attack, a 16-year-old Somali was attacked and stabbed in a gas station in West Seattle. A few days later, 6 Somali women were fired from their jobs. Our men are being harassed constantly from being Muslim and Somali. We are targeted by the media, by the citizen of this country, and almost we feel that we are back in Somalia with no voice and no right. Today, wearing a hijab, it has become a target. of being a terrorist. Becoming a Muslim, it was a sense of peace, but today it means we are killers. We are not. We came here the same reason a lot of your ancestors came to the United States. Freedom of religion, freedom of speech, but after September 11, we feel those rights have been taken away from us. Our girls, they cannot go out and shop because they are wearing the hijab. We are here in America, our new home, and we would like to tell our story, even though it's so painful, and I am only one person, but we're here, and we're here to stay. We are not terrorists, we are not murderers, but we're your neighbors, your schoolmates, your friends. Today, we're pleading with you. A lot of Somali have been deported. A lot of us are in fear. Do something about it. Do something about it.
My name is Karen Yoshitomi, and I'm the regional director for the Japanese American Citizens League. Sorry.
Take your time.
60 years ago, our nation turned its back on nearly 120,000 people and put them in American concentration camps, isolation centers, and federal prisons, the sole basis of which was ancestry. In this country, equality, fairness, applies to all people, regardless of ancestry, nationality, or religion. The Bill of Rights are the central compact between the federal government and the people of this nation, rights which cannot be set aside without individual review and due process. Mako Nakagawa has spent a lifetime devoted to education and community involvement. This despite the fact that at 5 years of age, she was an internee in a war relocation assembly center, euphemistically called Camp Harmony.
Camp Harmony.
At six, she was a citizen exile at Minidoka, and by 7 years of age, she was a prisoner of war in a Department of Justice isolation and detention center in Crystal City, Texas. Mako is here today to share part of her personal story.
Well, the stories are particularly touching for me because for many of us in our community, we hear these stories and it is not again. We heard these stories 60 years ago. And if there was one legacy from our experience, we were hoping that the legacy is that it will never happen again. 60 years ago. 60 years ago, I learned to put my hand over my heart and pledge allegiance to the American flag with liberty and justice for all. Isn't it ironic that I learned those beautiful, ideal American words when I was a prisoner in America's concentration camp? Oh my goodness, 60 years ago, it never should have happened. And the stories, my story is old, not recent, but 60 years ago, the stories are about the same. The FBI and the Seattle police came to my father's house early in the morning, shoved my mother aside, stormed into the house, ransacked the closets, made a mess, watching my father as he forced him to do his morning toiletry as he was being observed. My mother yelled upstairs, get dressed to my older sister because she liked to sleep in the nude. But I guess the FBI did not know what she was saying in Japanese, and they rushed upstairs drawing their guns. My sister remembers the FBI putting his hands into the sugar bowl and into the rice bins, and she was thinking, ooh, that's horrible. I remember that's the second time in my life I saw my mother cry. The first time was when Grandma died. But this time, her cry was very different. It scared me. It scared me. That's the only thing I remember is the second time I saw my mother cry. My father was an optimist. This was on February 21, 1942. Two days after Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which ultimately was the order that got us incarcerated. 2 days after that, it was also the day of my oldest sister's 11th birthday. That's the day that it happened. That day is a big day in our family history. Our father was taken away, and after he was gone, the house was a mess. It was a mess. My father was an optimist, and he decided he'd do his best to cooperate, and maybe if he really did a good job of that, he can be home for dinner to have birthday cake with the family. Of course, that was never to be. He said the first time he did feel like maybe he would not be able to get back with the family is when he was forced to strip naked, and they examined him. And he said the humiliation was such that he'll never forget. I could tell you story after story, but the point is the same stories are being told again today. That just cannot be, you know? Pramila said in her opening presentation that touched me, she said, "We say we are not willing to sacrifice those principles of liberty, democracy, and equality that defines us as a great nation. The cost is far too high to pay." 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry paid that price in 1942. You must make sure it doesn't happen again. When we say justice for all, it must be justice for all. It's not all but them. Very, very few people stood up for us. We dearly remember those that did. But very, very few people stood up for us then. And there was not an audience like this for us at that time. But America needs us again. I love America. With all her faults, I love America. But I think you and I in the audience, and the commissioners over there, we must do our very best to make sure that we live up to all our beautiful American ideals. For all, justice for all. Thank you.